Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We have of late been discussing those emergent events that would spring an island people out of from under the burden of Spain's long papal shadow, that they might come into the light as they came into their own. Without freedom of action, England could never fulfill her destiny to aid God's people, the Jews. Yesterday, we observed the preparations to resist tyranny with the limited resources available. We witnessed extreme measures employed by the Queen to get her people ready for the battle, especially the use of piracy. By placing the right people in the right positions, from government down to her military, she mobilized her nation for the coming conflict. When I left off, Francis Drake and his associate captains captured Spanish merchant ships, attacked major Spanish ports such as Cadiz, and destroyed Spanish foodstuffs and barrel staves in an attempt to cripple her adversary's preparations. At class end, we discussed briefly John Hawkins and his incredible insight of how to best fight this overpowering enemy, not on land, but at sea. While half the trees of the Pyrenees Mountains were being felled for use in Spanish shipyards, the Englishman Hawkins countered with advanced thinking that had the effect of stripping away from Her Majesty's ships all the traditions of medieval Europe, including grappling and boarding an opponent's ship at close proximity and cutting down those high towers. John instead looked towards a made-in-the-Navy solution. Fully aware that they could not match Spain's massive manpower, he chose to use powder, shot, and ordnance as a replacement solution. By lowering the towers, the ship's pitch and yaw were stabilized. This in turn allowed England to employ 18-pounders and 30-pound cannons all along the lengths of her decks. Additionally, Hawkins lengthened out English man-of-wars, making them shorter in height and narrower in the beam. The result was a low-bowed, swifter ship which could carry more canvas aloft and sail closer to the wind at the rate of 3 feet to every one of the Spanish. They called them the race-built ships. Lastly, John Hawkins was challenged by the shape of the ship's hulls. Having a tuna lunch one day, he could not but help but notice its beautiful configuration. At some point, he asked himself, why would God create the tuna fish with its curved and rounded body to dart this way and that, but the bottom of our ships are relatively flat? The question taxed him, but eventually led to a below-the-waterline testing. It was soon discovered that by replicating a tuna's shape onto the bottom of the existing hull, it allowed Her Majesty's ships a finer entry into the sea, but a long, narrow run out, making English ships bluff above and fast below. Most importantly, English ships now were able to change course more nimbly. This latter discovery was very much in keeping with Romans 1, verse 20. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by those things that are made. As for Queen Elizabeth, she did her part by allocating her portions of the proceeds from pirated Spanish supply ships to John Hawkins' enterprise. Looking back, I ask you the question, was all this just a product of happenstance, or was it more in keeping with the words of Isaiah 40, verses 28 through 31? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? He giveth power to the faint and to them that have no might. He increaseth, that they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up as wings of an eagle. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not be faint. Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes 11, verse 1, cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. By the spring of 1588, Henry VIII's fleet, having lied for decades unattended, suddenly became the center of attention. With the necessary monies provided, her old ships were now repaired in an amazing short time. Working day and night, her carpenters and shipwrights caulked and fatalloed by day, while different ships of men caulked and careened by the night. With sail and chain added and their guns lowered from the lower London Tower, the Royal Navy was finally ready. Across the way, so was Spain. By June of 1588, the Armada set sail. Painted with its bright colors, sails emblazed with the cross of the Catholic faith and blessed by their bishops. The Spanish weighed anchor and they sorted forth to rendezvous in the Atlantic with their admiral. Hardly, however, had they arrived when a strong summer gale accosted the fleet. So robust and vigorous were they that a goodly number of ships were blown far out to sea. Weeks went by in rounding them up, and these delays diminished Spain's food and water supplies and kept her men for long periods of time in the holds of those unhealthy ships. All these storms strained the limited supplies of the Spanish Navy before they had even reached the English Channel. By the 12th of July, the slow-moving armada, in crescent formation, rounded Land's End, England's southwestern coast. The golden gleam of the sun setting upon the armada's sails was both beautiful and foreboding, and the English watchers saw it as they arrived along the coast. That evening, the English Navy drifted out behind the armada, capturing the wind. Brothers and sisters, the truth be known, neither side had any idea of how to fight a modern naval battle, but soon they found out. Engaging in battle off the Lizard, the Eddystone, the Portland Bill, the two sides fought a two-week-long running gunfight up the channel. The Spanish ace in the hole was its famous crescent formation. All week it had held strong. On the fifth day of August, raised pennants and flag signals in the Spanish Navy relayed to the English fleet that the Spanish were encountering distress. Suddenly, the formidable crescent formation broke, and much of the Spanish Navy entered the French port of Calais. Attempting it to do in a night what they had failed to do in a year, the Duke of Medina Sidonia, which was their admiral, and his captains sought to obtain water, foodstuffs, but most of all, properly cured barrels, which they could not obtain in Spain. With part of their fleet inside the port and part outside, the Spanish were vulnerable. In the early hours of the morning and under the cover of darkness, the English sent fire ships in on the morning tide. Explosions from the flammable materials on board so frightened the Spanish captains that their first reaction was to cut their cables and beat a hasty retreat from the cramped harbor and outer bay. In the panic that ensued, some Spanish ships collided with one another, breaking bowsprits, entangling spars, and leaving crews on the docks. The confusion was so great that captains even boarded the wrong ships. Swearing and cursing, they drifted out to sea. Out of formation and having not acquired any of the desperate supplies, the Spanish ran in a short but crisp gale, which nearly grounded the whole fleet onto the sand dunes. Those that were not blown around found themselves later in a major melee with the aggressive English man-of-wars at a place appropriately named called Grave Line. Up till now, it was difficult to get at the Spanish because they were not in the open. Now they were in the open. Using the line-ahead tactic, they effectively damaged many of the larger ships. The English guns tore away at them, right and left sides. Some English ships even attempted to ram their prey into the rocky coast. Still, the Spanish breakout from Calais was successful, even if it came as a general rout. Although the English ships continued clawing tooth and nail at their fleeing tormentors, the majority safely got away. Damage is not destroyed. All that day and into the evening they pursued, but running out of powder and shot meant that the moment of victory had passed. Surely, tomorrow or the next day, the Spanish would return in a fighting unit, and this time they would possess the element of surprise and the choice of when and where to appear. With this eventuality, English sailors held their heads down. However, the wind suddenly picked up, and into the distance, a rumble could be heard. Now, brothers and sisters, we'll take a moment here to go back in time, because it was during the time when Elizabeth was in Whitehall that she encountered the Spanish representative, whose name was Don Bernardino de Mendoza. He represented the nation of Spain. And because of the pirating action of the English, he accosted Queen Elizabeth, saying, "Madame, you see a leaf fall, and you think you know which way the wind blows. Well, let me tell you, there is such a wind coming that will sweep away all your pride." But Elizabeth Tudor was not to be outdone. She countered, "I too, sir, can command the wind. Within me is a hurricane that will strip Spain bare if you dare try me." Psalm 83, verses 12 through 18. These are the words of David. "For those who say, 'We will seize for ourselves all the pastures of God's people,' scatter them, O God, like a thistle down, like chaff before the wind, like fire raging through a forest, or flames which blaze across the hills. Hunt them down with thy tempest, and dismay them with thy stormy wind. Let them be abashed and live in perpetual dismay. Let them feel their shame and perish. So let them learn that thou art the Lord, God most high over all the earth." In the disappointment felt by every Englishman, from admiral down to common seaman, they overlooked who really was in control of the weather gauge. They overlooked the power of God's word. That evening and into the next day, God came arrayed for battle. His dark clouds were a breastplate. Thunder became his trumpet, lightning his spear, wind his lash, and the high seas his rage. He who neither slumbers nor sleeps when his people's needs are at stake entered that battle with full complement of weapons. In the opposition camp were top-heavy Spanish galleons, with their holds overburdened with soldiers, Jesuit priests, horses, and cannon. They were no match for a cauldron of contrary winds and mountainous high sea swells. Soon those mint-green waters off the Scottish coast became for Spain a whitened shroud. By the time British ships gave off the chase at the border of Scotland, it was almost too late. Oh, woe betide any man who strives to throw oil on a raging sea after God has whipped them into a gale. By raining down upon their invaders a barrage of wind, rain, and sea, the wrath of God tore away their rigging, ripped apart their sails, crashed down upon their hatches. In the midst of the storm, bowsmen cast overboard boxes and bales, jars and cannon, and even horses, anything to lighten their vessels. But for most, it proved too little, too late. Unequal to the challenge, most of the Spanish armada could not negotiate the rocky outcrops of the Orkney, the Shetland, and the Outer Hebrides Islands. With a sound of snapping masts, splintered hulls, and broken jibs, also came the forlorn wails of desperation heard by both Scottish and Irish residents in the distance. Of the 150 ships that made up the armada, only 60 battered hulks would limp back to the Spanish ports, and then, only months later. Hal Fisher, in his book, The History of Europe from Its Earliest Time, summarizes it thusly. The fate of the Spanish armada was the first notification to the world that the Spanish Empire was not invincible. By some providence, difficult to reconcile with religious pride, the great armada had been brought to nothing by the heroic seamen of the north, but most of all by the wild blast of heaven. A long succession of reverses experienced by a religious people may either shake or confirm them in their faith. In the agony of the great Channel fight, the Spanish sailor exclaimed, "God has deserted us." Later, the nation was brought to believe that it was punished because it had deserted God. This miraculous deliverance was not lost on Queen Elizabeth. Never had there been such a one-sided naval victory. Indeed, not a single English ship failed to return that last night of combat. Now you think about that. Not one English ship was lost. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11 makes this very telling comment. Of course, this is the wisdom of Solomon. "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Yes, long after the parade ceased and the echo from churchyard bells had faded in the distance, Elizabeth took steps so that the nation would never forget to 1,000 generations." In somber reflection and pious gratitude, she ordered a minting of a bronze medal. It was inscribed with these memorable words, "God breathed, and they were scattered." With this event, Tarshish had her nativity. She's back. What began as a whisper eventually became a song. "Hail Britannia, Britannia rules the waves. She proclaims to all the earth, our God doth save." In brief summation, Britannia's baptism of fire had breathed into her new life. Despite her slow beginning, God had showed this Gentile witness his long arm of salvation, the way he had to Israel in the past. The confidence it fostered and encouraged, the continued religious atmosphere it fathered, and the reputation of the woman who ruled like a man, inspired her people with a sense of fear, if not awe. Indeed, a corollary of Spain's demise was an opportunity for the English woolens to trade in areas formerly denied to most Europeans, the Turkish Empire. More importantly, it drew them in closer to the land whose geography their children knew and understood better than their own land. Palestine. Ezekiel 27, verse 12. Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches. With silver, iron, tin, and lead, they traded in the fairs. Now, if you could just take that one off for a minute. Now, brothers and sisters, what you see here is me, of course, but behind me, you see a shadow. As in all shadows, it's not perfect, is it? What you see is simply a roughened outline, but you can still tell that it's me, right? And that's what I'm trying to paint a picture here of. What we saw in the past was reality, but it cast a long shadow into the future. For whatever God's reasons, because his ways are not our ways, he wanted to use a Gentile power to help his people. Little by little, we're going to see how these two great nations, or these two great peoples, will come together. It starts little, and it builds big. And as we get to the end, you'll see what I'm doing. This is not a history lesson per se. This is a history lesson, though, with a purpose. And the purpose is to show how two people come together and eventually bring about the greatest consequence, perhaps, of the 20th century, the return of a people after 2,000 years from dispersion to their land, feat that has never been accomplished in any other place or any other people. Now, we need to leave the seas surrounding Great Britain momentarily and turn yet another page in time. Up till 1571, trade with the despot of the East, Suleiman the Magnificent, was nearly impossible. No Muslim lord from the Scythian wilds was prepared to have anything to do with some Christian infidel. However, in the year 1581, a British company called themselves the Merchants of Levant were given a license to trade in Turkish waters. Why? And I've asked myself, why was England allowed to come in, but not France, not Spain, not some other great nation like Holland? Well, I believe the understanding that I have is that they were very, very impressed with this woman who ruled like a man and who wasn't afraid to thumb her nose at the Roman sea. Now, to understand how this worked, caravans with goods from the Far East passed through Arabia and Palestine, where their merchandise was bartered for in the marketplaces before being transshipped to the ports of waiting, where once pilgrims disembarked onto ports like Joppa and Acre in the 10th and 11th centuries, now bales of English woolens were carried down the gangplanks to be exchanged for spices and silks, wines, olive oil, carpets, and jewels. Despite the risks, and there were many, one shipment was worth a small fortune back in England. Unfortunately, the benefit to both England and Turkey was not transferred to the land of Palestine itself. The land that once was the jewel of the Middle East had by now wasted away into a desert. It wasn't all Turkey's fault, and some have said that, but years of warring people, Arab, Seljuk, Saracen, Christian, and Tartar, had been a harbinger for the coming Ottoman invasions and their destruction. Sometimes man-made, and sometimes from neglect, the terraced vineyards crumbled away, hillsides eroded, cisterns and aqueducts choked up with silt. As Barbara Tuchman expressed it, the land that supported the gardens and palaces of Solomon and all the crowded, busy world of biblical times was now but a backwater of the Ottoman Empire. But this was according as God had intended. Leviticus 26, verse 32 through 35. And I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies that dwell therein shall be astonished. And I will scatter you among the heathens, and I will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy her Sabbath as long as they lieth desolate. In 1601, the Levant merchants formed what would be known as the East India Company to deal directly with the people of the Sun's Rising, rather than work through Muslim traders. Still, for Britain, there were some very pleasant surprises to come out of their Near East trade, heretofore unforeseen. Of particular interest was the purchase of a fibrous plant, lovely, white, softer than down, and which could be picked from a bush. Anybody know what that is?
Cotton.
This plant we know today to be cotton. Eventually, its discovery and the transplanting of it in the Americas made Lancashire enormously rich, and England, for a while, the capital of the garment business. Secondly, from Persia, the Levant Company brought back plants, rare then, but commonplace now, to create what everyone sitting here knows as the famous English garden. Amongst these plants, we find lilies, irises, crocuses, hyacinths, daffodils, and laurel, only to name a few. So what started in Persia eventually brought much color to the English landscape. In brief summation, the trade with the Middle East from 1571 till the early 1600s had the effect of turning eyes of Englishmen eastward again. Remember, the only reason they crossed the Atlantic in the first place was because they were looking for a shorter route to the east. The sun sets in the west, but it rose in the east. Similarly, it was in the east that both Tyre and Tarshish aided God's purpose by supplying men, materials, and the wood required to build God's famous temple. With new Tarshish emergence, we now start the process of observing the importance of the Jew for English, for the English, and eventually the English for the Jew. Matthew. Isaiah 60, verse 9, reads as follows. Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from afar, their silver and their gold with them. With the death of childless Queen Bess in 1602, the closest relative to be eligible for the throne of Britain was a son of Mary, Queen of Scots, James VI of Scotland. Unlike his Catholic mother, Mary, James had at least been raised Protestant by the nobility of Scotland. Very Protestant, if that nasty little old man by the name of John Knox had anything to do with it. Later, when invited to become England's new monarch and unite the two countries into one, James and the court in Scotland agreed. Notwithstanding, James came to Britain with rose-colored glasses, being completely ignorant of their laws, their customs, and most of all, the Parliament. Bear in mind, James I believed, as did most European monarchs, that a king ruled by divine right. Only the king, he would argue, knew what was best for his people. Nicholas II argued the same, and he got him a firing squad. Be that as it may or may not, in England the king ruled by the consent of the people, and the House of the Commons were the people. However, that wasn't the worst of it. The most distasteful part of James I's experience with Parliament had to do with his personal budget. Now, there's the rub. To receive more than what the realm budgeted for, the king had to call the Parliament into session and give petition for an increase in taxation. Of course, if the House permitted an increase in taxation, they in turn wanted something back. It was a vicious cycle, a no-win situation from the king's point of view, a constant roadblock to ruling. Most important to our lecture was the attitude of mind it fostered, first in the king and then in its people. It was a one word, mistrust. Let me explain. Unlike Elizabeth, who worked with her parliament, James felt stifled by the laws of the people. Unlike Elizabeth I, who used the Privy Council to guide it and learned how to give when she had to, James I and his sons after him saw them as the enemy. He only called them when he was desperate for more money. Over time, this was going to lead to a serious conflict, if not under James I, eventually under the rule of his son, Charles I. Consequently, the king became increasingly more zealous for his rights and the ability to make decisions. You see, he was an educated man, and he very much enjoyed giving lectures on various subjects. His greatest contribution to the nation, economically speaking, was that he refused to get involved in foreign religious wars, as Parliament was pushing him to do. Unwilling to fight in Europe as the only Protestant nation, as Elizabeth had done, he soon came under suspicion by the Puritan-dominated House of Commons. It came even more so once he married a French Catholic princess, Henrietta Maria. Somehow, some way, he needed to get the people on his side. In 1604, at Hampton Court, an opportunity arose. The Puritan and Baptist leaders petitioned the king for the removal of Elizabeth's hated restrictions to their growing ecclesiastical organizations. Now, that petition would never have arisen had the Puritans truly understood the king's attitude about religious conviction. See, what James sought was not more freedom of religion. The fact is, he didn't want religion at all. The consequence of more religion he saw played out in battlefields ranging from Holland to Switzerland. No, what James desired was stability and surrender. For him, more autonomy by a highly volatile group of Puritans was a short ride to Bedlam. To those opponents of the Anglican Church, his words were short and to the point. Ye will conform, elsewise I will harry you right out of my land. Thus began the great Puritan migration to Holland and America. Shortly after these words were said, John Reynolds, the president of the Oxford College of Corpus Christi, stood up and requested the following. My Lord, would you at least consider the work of authorizing a new universal Bible for Englishmen to subscribe to? He indicated that the Bible printed in the times of Henry VIII and Edward VI were corrupt and not answerable to the truth. Now that request caught the attention of the king. Not being a stranger to the scriptures, James knew that in England, as in Scotland, there were too many versions in use. Tyndale's, Coverdale's, the Geneva Bible, even the former Queen's favorite, the Bishop's Bible, just to name a few. The more he thought, the more he saw a chance to kill two birds with one stone. Winston Churchill expresses it thusly, I quote, here, thought James, was a chance to rid the scriptures of misinformation and produce a uniform version which could be entrusted to all. Secondly, it would give the king some opportunity to increase his popularity at home. To this question, he suddenly surprised his detractors, agreeing to their request. However, if there was going to be a new Bible, he wanted it done without bias and certainly devoid of all those middle margin notes that in many cases held greater sway than the Word of God itself. Notwithstanding, in the matter of taking this project serious, James proved better than his word. In a few months, he gathered to London some of the finest religious minds in the realm. They were allowed a period of time to acquire the important reference material, Hebrew, Chaldean, and Greek resources, and also other editions of the Bible. In 1607, they formed into groups of 12 men and were stationed in different parts of the country so as not to compromise the legitimacy of their commission. The rules stated that any final draft would then have to be scrutinized by every other group, with disagreements noted and logged and later tackled by the entire session at large. As for marginal notes, the king made it quite clear that they were to be eliminated, except to cross-reference with other important verses or clarify a Greek or Hebrew word. With the king's eyes upon them, these men threw themselves into this work unalterably. If there was some means to measure triumph, we find it best, or we find it in the fact that after just 3 years and 9 months, the King James Bible, the new King James Bible, was ready for the king's signature. The year was 1611. To say that it was a success would be the greatest understatement of that time. It was an achievement par excellence. Not for 300 years would any changes be offered on a new English version created. Its use of language was both elegant and filled with grace. Well, I don't need to tell you. Its poetic resonance drew one in. Still, by far and away, the most important blessing of this newly printed Bible was the price. In 1611, as in the 1930s, a family could purchase a copy of the King James Version Bible for as little as 5 shillings. You think about that. Bibles before would cost thousands of pounds, way out of reach of the common people. But this Bible was reasonable. Everybody who wanted to read it now could do so. From old men to little children, this Bible was read. And it inspired so many things as a result of it. As the writer to the Bible magazine expressed it, indeed, after the translating work was done, the translators went through it again so that it would not only read better, but sound better, a quality for which it became famous throughout the English-speaking world. From both a literary and a truth point of view, it was hailed as the single greatest achievement of the time and another nail in the coffin for the return of papal rule. So while the world at large were not permitted to even come close to a Bible, a whole nation of people, English people, from old men to children, read the Word of God, taught their little ones from its pages, and received the light as best they could understand it. What is more, loyalty, morality, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, forgiveness, and obedience were all promoted from its pages, a plus for any nation. For the English, the Bible gave them the official godly code to live by. It became as precious to them as their own children, and they were determined that succeeding generations should have it. Moreover, it was a book that was going places. This was the age when new settlements in the Americas, Jamaica, and Canada were being opened up. Finding it impossible to get ahead in England, many a zealous religious person, adventurer, or just poverty-stricken man opted for the promise for a new life in the colonies. Wherever they went, they took two books with them, generally, Pilgrim's Progress and the King James Bible. Secondly, it revealed the people of the book, the Jews. Puritans and Baptists, which by James I were very much on the rise, placed a lot of emphasis on the reading of the Old Testament and New Testament scriptures. There was one other unexpected consequence of having your own Bible. You were constantly learning about their way of life, how they protected the Bible, where they came from, where they were going. No other source told you more about the people of God than this one book. Unlike the existing prejudices towards the Jews, the Bible did reveal the fact that, like them or not, they had for millennium been the custodians of this marvelous work and the reason Gentile men had it at all. This knowledge eventually led many in England, especially the Puritans and Baptists, to recognize that Jews may be scattered in every nation, but it was a prophecy that had not yet been fulfilled in England. As they saw it, the privilege to possess the Word of God obligated them to further help their exiled brothers to return to England and then to their ancient homeland. However, before that would occur, a civil war would break out. James I would not see it during his reign, as he died in 1625. But the forces at work for a more independent and powerful parliament overtook his son, Charles I. It lasted 7 years, from 1642 to 1649. When it ended, the king was overthrown and put to death, and the Puritan, Oliver Cromwell, became the Lord Protector of the English Republic, not monarchy. During that period of war, the Puritans were increasingly looked at as scamps by both the reigning monarch Charles I and his advisors. If they found difficulties in worships before the conflict, they now felt the heavy weight of restrictions and restraints intolerable, like a great foot on top of their chest. After a while, the saying gained favor: "It is better we go and live in Goshen than stay in our own country." Consequently, to escape the restrictions upon them, numerous English Puritans moved to Holland and some to the Americas. Significantly, in Holland, they first ran into Jews. Like themselves, they found them the product of exile, having left Portugal and Spain a century before, and even some more recent arrivals who had hid their faith, living as Moranos, in other words, Jews pretending to be Catholic. Now, the Jews had set up a very flourishing community in the town of Amsterdam, numbering many prosperous merchants. There they played an important role in the trade of the Dutch and the general European trade with the Levant or the Middle East. By their connections, Jews were able to derive products Gentile traders were outright denied or would not even attempt. If a primary factor in the foreign policy of England was the protection and encouragement of commerce, here were a people who could now make it come into play. The English government under Cromwell had been forced to adopt the Navigation Act, by which English ships could only carry English cargoes to trade in, thus effectively eliminating the cheaper competition from the Dutch. However, it would have been so much wiser to learn how to make a nation competitive than to use extreme measures which required the Navy to enforce. Although the Navigation Act helped, it also led to war with the Dutch, another Protestant nation. What a mistake. Clearly, these negative steps to protect trade were not sufficient. According to Cecil Roth, A History of the Jews, it was patent that Jewish merchants had been very largely responsible for the recent growth and prosperity of Leghorn, of Hamburg, and especially Amsterdam. Were they persuaded to settle in London, they might do as much there as well, he said, without the cost of armed conflict, loss of life, and the weakening of one's overall economy. Because of the Jews, there were well-developed banks, there were insurance companies, and even stock markets, which in combination placed the Dutch in 1649 in a most competitive state. Unlike the English shippers, the Dutch could offer better rates and understood the art of maintaining a national debt. Consequently, creditors were prepared to loan their government substantial amounts of money in confidence that the same would be paid back with interest. As a consequence, in 1649, there were 12 Dutch ships to every English vessel sitting at the dock in Copenhagen. To be more competitive, therefore, England needed to be more far-sighted in business and in adopting change. Moreover, with the arrival of the Jews, not only their wealth and ability would come with them, but their many worldwide commercial connections. The Jewish historian Cecil Roth actually states that in West Indian trade, Jewish influence was so strong there, and their introduction to England might prove no less useful than a naval and military action in making the Spanish Main a home for English trade. Here again, Jews showed the world at large what they could do commercially when allowed to ply their skills. In the year 1649, the very peak and midpoint of Puritan rule in England, two Puritans, Joanna and Ebenezer Cartwright, made a petition that, though nothing would come of it, showed where the thinking was for many of that little island nation. Remember, these are Puritans. Look at what they're saying here. I quote, "This nation of England, with the inhabitants of the Netherlands, shall be the first and the readiest to transport Israel's sons and daughters in their ships to the land promised to their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for an everlasting inheritance." Moreover, it added that the Jews may again be received and permitted to trade and dwell amongst us in this land. Brothers, sisters, and friends, I've often wondered, why did England have to go through a long civil war and wars with France, Spain, and Holland, which could only have the effect of weakening its ability in commerce, not strengthening it? I believe it took that to make them realize that there was a better way to gain prosperity, and that way was through coexisting with the children of Abraham. For Oliver Cromwell, the title Lord Protector was not just another designation for a king. A good protector is also a good leader. Like Josiah of Israel, he understood that abuse of God's law would lead to privation, deficiency, shortage, and hardship. And everywhere he looked, the effects of sin were seen. By imposing restrictions on the things like alcohol and making the Lord's Day a day of true worship of God, he sought to reform England into a more righteous nation. For him, the nation that worships together prospers together. However, he sought to make them even more successful without fighting foolish and wasteful wars. For Cromwell, the time was now to reverse Edward I's act of banishment of the Jews. This took place in the 13th century, the late 13th century, in 1290. By being a good Puritan, Cromwell knew God's mind on those who helped the Jews. He knew it to be the right course of action. However, it was easier said than done. Although an act of Parliament was required, Parliament dug in their heels and they refused to act. Every negative argument was rolled out before the parliamentary committee. Let that sit for a minute.
Must be near a nuclear power box.
Tornado. No way there's a
tornado. Every negative argument was rolled out before the parliamentary committee. Everything from being the most despised people in the world to using malevolent tactics to gain advantage. Okay, I think hopefully it's over. From destroying our Christian nation to performing blood rituals were all heard. In the end, it came down to his commanding presence, his overriding influence, his very force of will, which pushed the issue into a passive silence. For Oliver Cromwell, it all came down to those words found in Genesis 12, verse 3. I will bless those that bless thee, and curse those that curse thee, and in thee shall all nations of the earth be blessed. Just like ancient Tyre and Tarshish before him, he knew that the Gentile nations that aided his people would not only be blessed, but aided in their highest sovereign in heaven to meet their eternal purpose. If you turn now to Deuteronomy 8, 16 through 18, I'll put it on the overhead. Moses asked the question, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, with the fod which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do thee good at the latter end? And thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of my hand hath gotten me this wealth. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto his fathers, as it is this day. That's the real reason why Jews were given the ability to be prosperous, so that they had in the end the ability to establish God's covenant. Well, brothers and sisters and friends, this is where the undesigned coincidence finds fulfillment. What Cromwell could not know or could not hope to understand during his mortal life was that the lack of legislature to ensure them a homeland in England was the best thing that ever happened. In 1658, when Charles II and his brother James returned from Dutch exile due to the kindness of the English people, they, in a vindictive spirit, reversed every law that Oliver Cromwell ever passed. They even reversed his funeral arrangements by digging him up and desecrating his remains. Consequently, the only enduring legacy of his fateful 5 years of rule was the Jews. For whatever reason, Charles II and James II after him left the Jewish population of London alone to both increase and be a light to English commerce and trade. And in conclusion, yes, the Puritans and Baptists' timing may have been off, but they were right on track when it came with God's messenger, the Jews. As much as English historians tend to want to diminish that flame, it was real. Moreover, their presence was going to open the door for the future possibilities in the Mideast. See you tomorrow.